Aloha, and you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox, the station that loves you. And Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Al Pastor Tacos, George's Food Truck, and Kilauea Paint and Feed.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Al Pastor Tacos supports KKCR across the street from the craft fair in Kapa'a by the beach. Al Pastor Tacos serves fresh grilled local fish, steak, chicken, and pork tacos and burritos in the Al Pastor style. Open every day from 11 to 4. Al Pastor Tacos, authentic Mexican food. 652-6953.
Chef George of the Jungle Food Truck, now in Wailua at Kamokila Hawaiian Village, serving local burgers, gyros, and falafel. Also, Summer's Organic Shave Ice with fresh fruit. Open Sunday through Friday, 10:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. 783-0230 for takeout. Chef George of the Jungle supports KKCR.
Kilauea Paint and Feed Store, specializing in professional-grade Pittsburgh paints and paint sundries, premium pet food, and organic livestock feed, propane exchange and filling, too. Located just past the Shell station on Kolo Road in Kilauea, Monday through Friday from 7:30 to 5:30, and Saturday from 8 to 1. Locally owned, Kilauea Paint and Feed Store, 828-6655. The Kekau Foundation, license holder for KKCR Kauai Community Radio, will hold its quarterly business meeting Wednesday, April 29th at 6 p.m. at All Saints Church in Kapa'a. All interested parties are invited to attend. For more information, call Steve at 652-3706.
And mahalo for listening and supporting Kauai Community Radio. This is Felicia, and we are going to have just a great show today. I'm really excited about it. There's a broad range of topics, but everything is related. We're going to really limit calls in the first hour because I have scheduled strong callers, the first of which is University of Hawaii Law Professor Williamson Chang with his viewpoint on the larger picture of the Mauna Kea protection movement. I'm really excited to have him on. Councilman Gary Hooser is going to be calling in from Switzerland, where he is with Ohana o Kauai's Fern Rosensteel and Moms Hui's Malia Chun, and they are reporting from their field trip to speak to Syngenta headquarters and the Swiss government. Later on in the hour, towards the end of the hour, top of the hour, next 5 o'clock-ish, Councilwoman Joanne Yukimura and Lee Mori, who is really ma'a or smart on real estate, will be helping guide a discussion on housing and how our housing is really, you know, we're having limited housing. So that is a very big and important topic. Other couple things that we will go into, if time permitting, is just what a powerful week this has been. You know, globally, we've had the Chilean volcano go off. Pakistani flooding, they've had a lot of deaths and more intensive flooding there, and we've had the earthquake in Nepal. A lot of issues are coming together for that. Somewhat climate change and melting ice caps start to cause the Earth's crust to shift and move around. At least that is a strong theory. The Vanuatu cyclone, you know, has been... that's recovering. We'll talk about that a little bit if we have time. Locally, we'll speak about the Water Commission field trip. I just came back from that. Green energy is up and running. We've got some stuff about Ahua Moku, the DOT, Department of Transportation listening session, and a little bit giving a good thumbs up to KIUC, our power company, handling the rolling blackout. So now we are joined by University of Hawaii Law Professor Williamson Chang. Are you on there?
Yes. Hi, Felicia.
Hi. I am so delighted that you called in. I read your paper, your statement that you made for the University of Hawaii Board of Regents, and it was one of the most eloquent papers that I have read that speaks to so much more than just the Mauna Kea movement. But having you on, Can you help our listeners know a little bit more about who you are, a little bit of background on you, and then...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I was born and raised in Honolulu. I went to University High School for all 12 years. Then I went to Princeton University in New Jersey and then to University of California at Berkeley, where I got my law degree. I came back and I worked with Chief Justice Richardson and taught at the law school at the same time. I worked on a case that was very closely associated with him, which is the Hanapepe River water case, McBride versus Robinson. And it was a case that went on, and I know everybody in Kauai knows the fame of that case.
Mm-hmm.
It was the case in which the waters, which were used to be privately owned by the sugar companies, were held to be in a public trust for the people. So it was a landmark case where something that was private but had always been communal or public during the kingdom days was restored to its former status. And after that, well, we have the water code, and the water code is based on this public trust idea. So I worked with the Chief Justice and taught, and I did beach cases where we expanded the beaches of Hawaii so that the people would have more of the beach, and the private owners who went up to the high water, the vegetation line would be the high water mark, not the limu line on the beach. And I did the case involving who owns the new island that's going to come up off the big island in thousands of years, I suppose. But I have basically been a teacher, and I've taught for 39 years. I did work for the Senate, United States Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs. I've taught at four or five other law schools, including Wisconsin. I've done a lot of water rights and legal history, and I'm doing a lot with Native Hawaiians and the sovereignty movement and the resuscitation of the Kingdom of Hawaii, because my research has been into the annexation of Hawaii, and I found some very surprising things. So naturally I was interested in Mauna Kea because it raises issues as to who owns the lands and does the government have the power. But more than that, when I heard a lot of the discussions and when I've talked to a lot of the young people on the mountain and when I talked to the young people who are my students, I saw it as more than just about sacred Mauna Kea, but about social justice, and especially about the next generation of young people, the millennials, and what they face in Hawaii. So I've been teaching for 40 years and live in Honolulu, and I'm very happy to be on the show.
Well, I am so pleased to have you on the show. I would like to have you on more shows. I think that your background, your history speaks to very much. And do you have that letter that you wrote to the Board of Regents?
Yes, I do.
'Cause now, were you able to present that to them?
No, you have to sign up, and they were only there till 3 o'clock, so only half of the 120 people who signed up spoke, and so I didn't get to speak on that Thursday. They held another session the next Sunday, but I didn't have the money to go. So
you flew over to Hawaii Island and
flew there especially to testify for the BOR, and I brought this, and I didn't get to testify. But they didn't hear it, but it's available. It's on my ScholarSpace link, which it's on the letter. If you go to HawaiianKingdom.blog. And read the letter there, at the very end there's a paragraph which says, if you want a link to the document and the other 59 pages, you click on that little link and you can get what I wrote.
Are you a Facebook guy?
I'm not very good at Facebook at
all.
You're
all over Facebook everywhere.
Oh, I can't
so
find
it's
myself.
It's all over. This letter is definitely, well, it's resonated with many people. So I'd love to hear it.
Okay, shall I read it?
Please do. I was even going to read it, but then I thought
okay.
I'd like to get the man himself. So thank you for doing it. So if you could read it to everybody.
Okay, I don't mind.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start out by saying that something to the border regions. I work for them. I've worked for them for 40 years. It's been an honor, and I must admit, though I have problems with what they're doing right now, great problems, they did give me the chance to be an independent scholar, that I didn't have to work in corporate law or work for the lawyers who represent the TMT or anything like that. And so I start my letter by saying, Honorable Board of Regents, I have had the honor and pleasure to serve as a professor of law at the University of Hawaii for the last 59 years. I have served the university and the community well. I am also grateful for the opportunity to serve and work in the university. Then I say, let me start by saying this. I know a place, I know a country where there would never be a question whether to build an 18-story, 30-meter telescope on the summit of Mauna Kea. That country, that nation, is Hawaii. Before 1893, it would have been unthinkable that the government of the Kingdom of Hawaii would ever conceive of such a plan. Yes, Kalakaua loved astronomy. All Hawaiians loved the stars. However, they loved Mauna Kea even more. Mauna Kea is sacred. It is the Sky Father. It is the essence, the beginning of creation. It is the beginning of the Hawaiian people, the islands, the taro. They're all descendants of Mauna Kea. When I say Mauna Kea is sacred, I don't mean sacred in the way most people use that term. I mean sacred not in the same sense of to worship. I use sacred in the sense of precious or so important that nothing else counts or so important that I might even have to break the law to save it. I apply it to those things and people that we care so much about that we would do anything to preserve their existence. For example, the child of a parent, especially a young child, is sacred in this sense. So are parents to their children. So are grandparents. Even the family pet is sacred. If your house was burning down, would you risk your life to go into the burning house to rescue your children, your mother, your grandparents, even your beloved dog or cat? Would you go even if you were forbidden or stopped by firemen or policemen? Yeah, I think the answer is yes. All of us would go without hesitation, without thinking of the consequences. We do that in a number of situations. Would you give a kidney to save or extend the life of your child, your brother, or your uncle? Would you spend all of your money to save a loved one from, excuse me a minute, I gotta turn the page, from cancer? Sure you would. From other diseases, Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS? Or would you do everything you could to save a relative from a life in prison without parole? Yes, we all would. Moreover, we praise such emotions and desires of others who make such sacrifices every day. We understand the soldier who sacrifices himself by instinctively jumping on a grenade. We understand the parent or grandparent who gives all their hard-earned life savings to see their child or grandchild through college. Whether one worships Mauna Kea or not, whether one considers it sacred, does not matter as much as understanding the instincts that drive those to defend and save Mauna Kea, much as one would understand the absolute love for a child or a parent, even if such acts break the law. When we see the instinct of family, of brotherhood, of sisterhood, of love for mankind and others, we celebrate that. We gravitate to that. We love and defend Mauna Kea because it reminds us of what makes us human. Sacred is not necessarily a place. It is a relationship, a deep relationship, beyond reason, beyond law, beyond rationality. The Mauna Kea movement is a movement that has grown because of young people. They live in a new, confusing world themselves, a world of what I call cognitive dissonance. That is, they live with an outright contradiction, a Hawaiian decline where there is nothing they can do about that decline. They see their world being attacked and destroyed, its waters taken, its plants doused with foreign chemicals, its agricultural lands disappear in the name of gentlemen farmers, its open lands used for artillery practice, and its shorelines becoming high-end condominiums that only the rich foreigners can afford. Moreover, to the young, Hawaii is unlivable. There is no viable future. There are no places to rent, no jobs that fit our young people's educational training, no money for retirement, and there's the endless life-sapping traffic congestion. And now, an 18-story telescope on Mauna Kea? That's the last straw. It would never be built on other sacred sites, not over the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the Dome of the Rock, the Temple of Angkor Wat, not at Gettysburg, Arlington, or even the Arizona Memorial. No one would think of putting a pair of glasses on the eyes of God. Why then Mauna Kea? We and our youth are inundated today with the attacks on the treasures of the earth, and we ask why. So what happened to this nation called Hawaii, where Mauna Kea was loved and adored? Hawaii was a nation that by a series of events, starting with an overthrow in 1893 and ending with annexation in 1900, by which another nation, the United States, forcefully took the sovereignty of Hawaii. What do I mean by that, to take another nation's sovereignty? Well, there are many different ways to think of sovereignty. One is that sovereignty is the monopoly of a government on the legitimate use of violence. What do I mean by that? Sovereignty means that the government who has sovereignty is the only one who can legally use violence in that society. By that I mean the state, the police, and the DLNR are the only ones today who can do so-called legal violence to Mauna Kea. Similarly, the police of Hawaii County and the officers of DLNR are the only ones who can use the violence of arresting and jailing or fining people to force down the protesters, the protectors of Mauna Kea. Protect the mountain and you go to jail. That's so-called legal. It is called the law. It is a power possessed only by the sovereign of a nation. Yet there was once a time in Hawaii when that sovereignty, that monopoly on the use of legal power, protected, not defiled, Mauna Kea. In 1893 and 1900, a new nation took over in Hawaii, a new nation with new rules. These were new rules that had the power to interfere with our very human emotions and instincts, instincts derived over time from our kupuna, our ancestors, and the culture of this nation of Hawaii. Hawaii has changed. Today, government has the legitimate power to do great violence to our families as well. Government agencies can take a child away from a parent. Government agencies can put a Hawaiian in prison for the smallest of offenses, denying him or her freedom and the chance to be with and raise their families. The world of Hawaii for our young people has been turned upside down. The answer lies in power, that is law, the shift over their lives by which all is reversed. In 1898, the United States, by joint resolution, took the nation of Hawaii. Now, I am a legal historian, and in the appendix I attach to this testimony, I show my work, and in my work it conclusively and definitively proves that the joint resolution had no power to take Hawaii. It was impotent. It was an act of Congress. It was a mere bill. It was a law. It was not a treaty between Hawaii and the United States. A law of Congress could no more take the nation, the sovereign nation, the independent nation of Hawaii, than Hawaii, by a law of its own legislature in 1898, could have taken the United States. It was a fraud. It created a disease that spread, a malaise we all suffer from, and it's called the myth of annexation. You see, we all believe we are part of America now. This myth is so pervasive, so powerful, that not only do we believe it, and have been led to believe it, but Americans have believed it, and the people of the world believe it. We all act as if it were true. We have been taught that way. We follow the lead of others who act that way. Everyone acts as if we are part of the United States. We're not. The truth is that the joint resolution did not give to the United States the monopoly on the use of legitimate violence. A violence to build a Mauna Kea, the violence to arrest those who seek to stop that building. Most of all, the university claims Mauna Kea by lease, a lease derived from the joint resolution. It is said that the joint resolution gave Mauna Kea to the United States, which gave it to the state of Hawaii, which gave it to the university. As a matter of law, that is false. It is a lie. The university has no claim of title or power of Mauna Kea. It cannot build. It cannot give permits. It cannot arrest us. The mass of young people are here today in protest because they live in a world of what I call cognitive dissonance. They live in a world where they are learning at the university today for the first time about the truth of the joint resolution and the sovereignty that the United States claims over Hawaii. They're learning about the fact there's no treaty, that the claim is, the official claim of the United States is that it got Hawaii by a law passed by Congress, by a mere law, which gives no power, no sovereignty to the United States. These young people, outside of their classes, they see the state taking what they love, preventing them from running into the burning house to save their Mauna Kea, their father, their sky father. And it's this dissonance that makes our youth ill. It makes our youth sick. It is a crisis that creates mental illness. It creates tension. In short, to build a Mauna Kea is to cast a sickness through these islands, a sickness and a sadness, not only on Native Hawaiians, but on all the people who live here. So I have included more, if you go to my ScholarSpace link, and I'm writing a book. That's the cognitive dissonance we live with. We must obey laws where we can't save our beloved grandfather or beloved sky father by laws that have no legitimacy. And people can punish us for that. So I say to all of you, mahalo and mahalo ke akua. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for writing and reading that. And that really resonated with me because we see here, whether it's people struggling when they see their children having seizures, if it's the pesticides or wanting to know what is causing the thing, and we don't really know. We don't know. We know that there are so many multiple toxicities. There's so many issues that are around. People feel a little bit powerless when we don't have a place to live, which to me, that can basically fray the social fabric necessary for individual and community stability. We have all those challenges, and I see them interrelated. Do you currently work with students? You said you're still teaching?
I am still teaching. I'm in my 40th year.
And so just for the listener who might have tuned in, this is University of Hawaii Law Professor Williamson Chang. And restating it, you got your education at Princeton and Berkeley, was that
right?
So by Western standards,
I learned the skills and the approach of the West, and I came back. I'm Native Hawaiian, and I came back, and it's been very painful to live here. And I got to admit, even for me, it's unlivable. It's getting to be a situation where even if, well, if you're old, you're paying $10,000 a month for a care home. If you're young, you can't afford a house. The old tickets to being in the middle class, I always tell you, go to medical school, go to law school. Those don't guarantee you anymore even owning a house in Hawaii. We see our young people being told to get an education, yet that education does not lead them to the life that they were promised. We see, as you put it, we see chemicals in our food. We see our water being diverted. We see our homes being bought up by foreigners who are wealthy. We see that we're going to live in apartments or condominiums for the rest of our lives. We have great concerns about our own children. I mean, this is not what Hawaii was supposed to be. Hawaii is basically unlivable, and the generation that is going to have to deal with that and suffer that are the millennials, the generation that's 18 to 25 right now. And it's very sad. And so Mauna Kea becomes the last straw. It's like, now you're attacking my grandfather? Now you're going to deny him a home? Now you're going to deny him care in his age? You have no respect for him? Mauna Kea is ohana. Mauna Kea is family. That's what Hawaii is about. The land and the people are family. The land is alive. The life of the land is preserved in its righteousness. So it means the land is alive. And it's preserved in the righteousness of how you treat the land and your family. And we got taken over, and we just are beginning to learn that it was illegal, and we cannot protect our families.
So what age were you at when you were a child, did you believe the story that it was all pono,
yes,
our history?
I was in fourth grade, and I went to my teacher, and I was doing Thanksgiving, and we drew pictures of pilgrims and turkeys and things like that. We don't have turkeys in Hawaii, and we didn't have pilgrims in Hawaii, so I went to my fourth grade teacher and said, how did we become part of this United States of America? And she said, we were annexed. And I said, oh, okay. And I believe that until 1994, when I discovered in Hamilton Library.
So you were a grown man in 1994.
I was a grown man. I read for the first time the congressional record of the debate in the United States Senate over the joint resolution, and I read the words of senators who were saying the following things. They were opposed to annexation, and they were opposed to the joint resolution, and they were saying things like, are you guys crazy? This is just a law. How can the law reach out of the United States and grab another people? The laws of the United States have only effect within the United States. If the laws of the United States could grab other people, why can't their laws grab us? And I was just shocked. I was just shocked. The other thing that shocked me was they used the joint resolution to transfer all the lands of Hawaii to the United States. So they use the joint resolution for two purposes. One, to take the sovereignty over Hawaii, which is power, not the real property like land or real estate. But they also took it to take about 1.8 million acres of the land for their own the interest. That's how they claim Mauna Kea, that by a document which is written by the United States, never consented to by Hawaii, an act of their Congress in which nobody else signed, they claim that Mauna Kea and 1.8 million acres of Crown and government lands is theirs. So what I realized was stunning. What I realized was nobody ever took Hawaii away from the Hawaiian people. What they took was our minds. They took our minds and made us believe that the United States had taken the lands legally. So I cried because I realized I always believed the aina was sovereign. In Hawaii, the aina is the power. You can't take a rock out of Hawaii. Why? Because if you do and go to the mainland, you'll get cancer. And people are sending rocks back all the time, and they're piling up in the post office. I believe that you could never take the land of Hawaii, because it was so powerful, away from Hawaii. And I was right. Nobody took it. What they took was our minds. And so what this is about is learning our history. And, you know, it's sad, but I was the first one to read this in 1994, and I wrote a little thing called A Rope of Sand, the same title as my new book, and it's in Hamilton Library, where I said, this is incredible. And I think it passed around a little bit, but I tried to do something about it, but I was punished.
In what way?
Well, I went to court and try to tell the judges that they didn't have jurisdiction, because they represented for free a Hawaiian family that said they were the heirs to Queen Kalama and so had an interest in a small island very south of Hawaii called Palmyra.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners of Palmyra got very mad. They were a Haole couple, and they sued us for what they call slandering their title, making claims that they said were false. Just claim. I was just saying things. And it went to court, and the federal district court judge fined me for $76,000 for saying that.
Wow.
And that was in 2000.
And you're listening to KKCR, Hanalei Ke'ekiwe Kilauea. This is Kauai Soapbox. We have UH Law Professor Williamson Chang on the line with us. So, well, that's powerful. And so you had to pay it?
They garnished it out of my wages. Yeah, I paid it. It's like, why did I pay it? Oh, I had to pay it. But it's like those who get arrested on Mauna Kea. It's an act that you do that's in the spirit of civil disobedience, that has its origins in Socrates and Martin Luther King and Gandhi, where you're willing to take the blows of a immoral, illegal government because you're showing that you believe that there is such a thing as law that exists. They don't employ the right law. Their laws are immoral, but there are rules to this world. You're not going to break those rules, but you're going to disobey their rules, and you'll take the punishment if they dole it out. It's Aloha Kapua, which they call it in the mountain.
Yes. And Professor Chang, are you able to hold for a moment? We have Gary Hooser. You'll be able to listen in. He's calling in from Switzerland. Him and
of
two
course.
People went and to talk to Syngenta directly in the Swiss government. So you'll be on the line. And Councilman Hooser, are you on the line? Can you put him on? No, missed, dropped. Okay. Well, he'll pop in on us very soon. We're going to try and pull him up. He's calling from a long way away, so there's a little bit of a struggle pulling him up. But so when we are looking, even like as we segue into what he's speaking about, when they're going to another country to speak to them about what their corporation is doing in our country. You know, we have global corporations are almost beyond nations.
Yes. They have more power than many nations.
Right. Yeah. And we're looking at these transnational partnerships, these treaties, like trade agreements, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. To me, what's happening with Mauna Kea and the 30-meter telescope is sort of a little forerunner of something of that nature. So Gary's going to be coming on the line now. Gary, are you there? Councilman Hooser?
I am here.
Yay.
How are you doing?
Good. So the show before me played the clip as you started to speak to the Syngenta board. Can you give us an update? What's going on?
Well, it's 4:30 in the morning here in Basel, Switzerland. And we had a fabulous week here, actually, in terms of getting the message of Kauai out to the people of Switzerland. And yesterday, as you know, I was able to speak to the shareholders and the board of directors. And Fern Rosensteel was also there filming me for part of it. And then the security got involved. But at the end of the day, Malia Chan and Fern and I had a very successful trip, again, getting our message out to the people of Switzerland. Every newspaper in every city in Switzerland, the TV stations were reporting on it. And the people of Switzerland are shocked at how their company, Syngenta, which is a Swiss company, is operating in our community. Our message basically was, Syngenta cannot do in Switzerland what they're doing on Kauai. They cannot spray atrazine, they can't use paraquat, and a number of other things. They can't even grow any GMO crops at all. We had a great reception from the people, people on the street. We met with members of parliament, trade unions, a lot of different nonprofit organizations, and just spent 5 days, hour after hour, meeting with people and getting the message out.
And did Syngenta give you any kind of response, or did the Swiss government?
Well, Syngenta did give me a response, and in the same response the local Syngenta on Kauai gives us, which is we're following all the laws, the pesticides are safe. You know, we're good neighbors. And we tried to point out to Syngenta and to everyone else that they're not following all the laws, that they're not being good neighbors, and that we have some serious concerns that are very simple. Felicia, the one thing the Swiss people could not understand, and the politicians and everyone, they were just flabbergasted that we would have to pass a law just to know what's going on in the field next door. You know, that we would have to pass a law so we could shut our windows before they sprayed the pesticides. The people just were flabbergasted. They said that would never happen in Switzerland. Never happen. Switzerland is a very democratic society, direct democracy. They could not believe that the people and the council voted on something and the community, you know, passed a law and that Syngenta refused to follow it. They just thought that was outrageous.
Were there other people from other countries that were doing a similar effort? Were you there for an event? Was there I think I saw a picture with a panel discussion. Was it just
yes.
the three of you from Kauai,
yes.
or was there other countries and other places?
There were other countries. There were several other countries. The organization that sponsored the initial conference is an organization called MultiWatch. And MultiWatch is a Swiss nonprofit that monitors transnational corporations like Syngenta that are based in Switzerland and operate around the world. And we had representatives from Paraguay there. We had representatives from Pakistan and other parts of the world. And issues ranging from the pesticide exposure to the genetic engineering experimentation, food systems and labor issues. discussing Syngenta's practices among working people in Pakistan. We had some excellent speakers from Holland. And there's one gentleman, his name slips my mind, but he's a well-known researcher with the United Nations food section. And he talked about the answer to feeding the world is not industrialized agriculture at all, but it's small food systems, organic food systems. And it was well-researched, and we'll be bringing this information back with us also.
Are you coming home with any sort of sense of hope? Are you feeling flat? I mean, I think it's great that you're bringing it before the world. What can we latch on to that this might be moving us forward?
Well, I think we can latch on to that, this is a global issue. Malia Chan said it best over and over again. This is not about our backyard so much as it's the world's backyard. You know, what the people of Switzerland are responsible, the people of Kauai, we all share this common responsibility. And so the connection with people around the globe dealing with similar issues and successful in many ways in helping each other, I think that is a real message of hope that we're bringing back. And we can, plan to continue this effort as all of us on Kauai who are concerned about these companies. And it's not just Syngenta, of course. You know, Syngenta happens to be a Swiss company, and we came to Switzerland. But BASF, DuPont Pioneer, and Dow Chemical, Monsanto, they all need to have to hear the message that we are not going to go away, that our concerns are valid, and they need to respect and honor our communities. And that was a message we gave. I think that's a message that was received. I think the Swiss government officials are much more aware than they were. We had just a great sense of awareness, and were treated very well by the Swiss population in general.
That's wonderful to hear. I have on the other line University of Hawaii Law Professor Williamson Chang, and we've been discussing the context relative to Mauna Kea and the 30-meter telescope. There is overlap in these issues, really actually powerful overlap on what global corporations' decisions can be made really without the permission of the people who live here, Hawaiian and otherwise.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other shocking thing, and I'm a grown man, as you know, and I have a background in business, and I believe in free enterprise. But sitting in that Syngenta shareholder meeting and hearing them go through their business of this multi-billion-dollar international corporation, it was clear that their operations are driven purely by money. I mean, that's it. They talked about the $40 million in bonuses the board members were going to get. At the same time, they're laying off 500 people in Switzerland. And they're not driven by, the good of humanity. In fact, there was greenwashing, basically. They're talking about their sustainable growth plan, which is crazy. It's bizarre and somewhat surreal to hear these large multinationals talk at these meetings. But listen, I have to go. We're going to Zurich this morning.
All right.
And I really appreciate, all the work, Felicia, you've done on KKCR and other issues in our community. I want to thank you for that and KKCR in general. And there's so many people on Kauai, and that's really what we felt like we were doing. We were speaking on behalf of the 4,000 people that marched. Speaking on behalf of the mothers, and all the people that work so hard on this issue and that care so much about our community. We really felt empowered by that every time we spoke. And so please, just to everyone, I offer my aloha from all of us, from Fern, Malia, and myself. They may call in later. I'm not sure. They're on their way to the airport or the train.
And I can see from looking at my computer that you have listeners from the other islands, too, as well as Japan and the United States and many different places. So you're being heard.
Well, thank you. And, much of the information has now been posted on Facebook, and other places, and we'll be putting out. I have the complete text of my remarks. I did have my cell phone on in my pocket recording myself. So even though security wouldn't allow Fern to complete the filming, I do have it all on audio, and we'll post that as soon as we can.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in, and you have a safe flight home.
Thank you, Felicia. Aloha.
Aloha. Okay, Professor Chang, are you still there?
I am still here.
All right. Do you have any thoughts on that? I'm actually looking to you to give us a little bit of words of hope, you know? I mean, like, how do we make a difference? How do we, you know, when you say, yes, our minds have been stolen, I think there's also a pretty heavily armed presence here, whether that is through local police that are now armed really to fight the Al-Qaeda or whatever it might be. How do we bring it back? Do you have any guidelines for us?
Sure, I do. I've been thinking about this a lot. And the first thing is, like Nelson Mandela employed in South Africa, it's a process of truth and reconciliation. Truth first. In other words, we're just beginning to learn the truth. It's only been a year since I've come forward with my work. After I got sanctioned for that $76,000, I went and disappeared, sort of. It was a week before 9/11, and so it was very hard to criticize the United States for a number of years. You were considered a traitor. But last April 2014, I gave a talk at the University of Hawaii with Keanu Sai, and I said that the United States, by its own laws, and I haven't mentioned this yet on this show, the United States, by its own laws, admits that the Hawaiian Islands are not within the state of Hawaii or within the United States. And that's the first time I've said that in 20 years. So that's new ground. Dr. Tsai has been consistent about his arguments that the Kingdom of Hawaii, which was recognized by the world in 1843 and 1844, continues to exist as a nation. It doesn't disappear when there's an overthrow. It doesn't disappear when another country occupies you. The burden is on the United States to show that that the Kingdom of Hawaii has been extinguished. And he has a very good point. There was no treaty by which the United States acquired Hawaii, and all the lands of the United States that have been added to the United States over the years have been acquired by treaty. Not by joint resolution, but by treaty. And there is no treaty of annexation. So there's no treaty of annexation, no treaty, and this law called the joint resolution has no power to acquire Hawaii. And so how did the United States get Hawaii? We have something called the burden of proof in law. And it's like the presumption of innocence. You're presumed innocent until you're proven guilty. You've heard of that, probably.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you're presumed to be Hawaii and still be Hawaii until someone else shows you, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they have taken your country legally, or they have the documents that show that there was a treaty. So what people are saying now, what people have learned in the past year, this came out in the DOI hearings, they're saying, where's the treaty? No treaty? And the other thing they're saying is that since the joint resolution also is the basis for the United States claims and the state of Hawaii's claims over the so-called ceded lands, which were the crown and government lands of the kingdom, show me the title. Show me a clean title. It goes back to the Mahele for the lands of Mauna Kea. The university leased it from the state. The state got it from the United States. The United States can't show who it got it from. That's the break in title. You know, like when you buy a house, list and you do a title search, what the title search is a guarantee that the person you're getting it from really owns it. So that person is going to show you who they got it from. And all the way back to Kamehameha the Third and Mahele, so it goes A to B, B to C. C gave it to D, and D gives it to you, and there's no break. That's good, meaning there's no break in the title, and so you have a clean claim to title. As to Mauna Kea, which is Crown and Government lands, the university has a lease to it. It got the lease from the state. The state got it from the United States, but the United States can't show how it got it from the Republic of Hawaii, which was the last government of Hawaii, the one that overthrew the Kingdom of Hawaii. So the embarrassing thing is if they have the burden of showing that they own the land, they can't prove it. And so that's why there's so many unanswered requests. Like last year, there was a letter sent to Secretary Kerry saying, asking, does the Kingdom of Hawaii still exist? My question to Attorney General Holder was, I'm reporting war crimes in Hawaii. You're supposed to investigate those. No reply. Mauna Kea will be the test. Because one of the defenses I'm going to raise for the protesters is they weren't arrested within the jurisdiction of the court. Their Mauna Kea is not within the state of Hawaii by the laws of the state of Hawaii itself, by the laws of this, by the constitution of the state of Hawaii. Why not? Because they couldn't put it in because they have no claim for it. It's like, if you found a bicycle, you don't have the receipt for it, right?
Right.
And the United States doesn't have a receipt for Hawaii. So what it did with the joint resolution is write up its own receipt. It said, it wrote down, Hawaii having sold it to me, I accept it. But who wrote that part about Hawaii having sold it to me? The United States. That's what the joint resolution is. It's an agreement that the United States made up to fool us. And in fool us, they did. They did it beautifully, and that was all my 20 years of research into how carefully the deception has been put into the law.
So, Professor Chang?
Yes.
I happen to have, for our next topic here, Lee Mori, who is, are you the past president or the current president?
Past
president of the Kauai Board of Realtors, and she's kind of nodding her head at a lot of the things you're saying, but she says she has a question for you. Can she ask a
sure.
question?
Thank you, Professor. Thank you for bringing up this information. I actually had no idea of the history, and I really appreciate you enlightening me. My question is that there, what government was in power when the annex took place, and were they complicit with the United States of America when they annexed Hawaii? Because it has to work from both sides.
You're very right.
It's just like in the GMO thing also, too, the pesticide thing. If we didn't allow it, it wouldn't happen.
Yes. Okay. I nail on the head, which was there a government in Hawaii in 1898 that was willing to give Hawaii to the United States and gave Hawaii to the United States, even if there's no treaty, right?
Yes.
And the answer is this. The government is called the Republic of Hawaii. It succeeded to the provisional government. The provisional government overthrew the Kingdom of Hawaii. Now, the provisional government, there's one way to look at it is this. The provisional government's taking of the Kingdom of Hawaii was viewed by the President of the United States in 1893 as an act of war and a violation of international law and a violation of treaties. President Cleveland in 1893 promised to restore Queen Liliuokalani to the throne. He was never able to do that because he was blocked by Congress. He was never able to do that because what it meant would be to go to war. The United States would be going to war against Lauren Thurston and Sanford Dole, who were basically Americans. And the American people couldn't see that happening. They also couldn't see putting a monarchy back into power because the United States prides itself on being a democracy. So it never happened. The monarchy... The provisional government, though, was not very democratic at all. It didn't allow Hawaiians to vote. It allowed only a very small number of people to vote. They elected the legislature. So they didn't have a very good reputation and public image in the United States. So they changed themselves into what's called the Republic of Hawaii by a constitutional convention. Because the idea of a republic is more acceptable to the United States people than this revolutionary government. So what was in power in 1898 was this Republic of Hawaii. And so the first argument that's often made is the United States put the provisional government in power through the military force it used to overthrow the kingdom. Then the provisional government transformed itself into the Republic of Hawaii. And so the argument is you've got a puppet government in the provisional government, and you have the offspring of a puppet government in the Republic of Hawaii, so it could never be a nation capable of exercising a treaty with the United States to give away Hawaii. Because why? Because it's really a puppet of the United States. It would be like the United States giving itself Hawaii. There is an argument against that, which is nations around the world did extend to the Republic of Hawaii recognition as a country. So let's assume the best possible case for the United States, which is even though the provisional government was a puppet, let's assume that the Republic of Hawaii that comes after the provisional government is not a puppet, but a real government. The question you asked is a very good one. Did that Republic of Hawaii enter into a treaty with the United States? And the answer is they drafted a treaty in 1897. Why? Because President Cleveland lost the election to President McKinley in 1896, and McKinley was pro-takeover of Hawaii. He was a Republican. And so one of the things he did first while in office was negotiate a treaty with the Republic of Hawaii in Washington. A draft of that treaty was signed on June 16th of 1897. The terms of that treaty are that, like most treaties, it has to be signed by both countries, or what we call ratified. It has to be approved by the legislatures of both countries. So representatives from Hawaii took the treaty back to Hawaii, and the Secretary of State of the United States took the treaty to the Senate. In Hawaii, it passed very quickly because the Republic of Hawaii was in power. Hawaiians were not in power. Hawaiians were not in the legislature or the Senate. So the Senate of Hawaii ratified the Treaty of 1897 on September 9th of 1897. The treaty was taken to the United States Senate as well, but what happened is the Kauai petitions. The Hui Aloha Aina and thousands and thousands, 21,000 Hawaiians signed petitions protesting the Treaty of Annexation of 1897. They signed two petitions, so there was 31,000 signatures by these 21,000 Hawaiians. One petition said, Hawaiians are opposed to the Treaty of Annexation. The other petition said Hawaiians are opposed to the annexation as well as want their country restored. That was delivered to the United States Senate in the winter of 1898, and that blocked the United States Senate from voting on the treaty and affirming it. Now, the United States Constitution says if you're going to ratify a treaty as the U.S. Senate, you must do so by a two-thirds vote of the senators present. It's not a simple majority. You have to get a supermajority of two-thirds to approve a treaty. They never could get the two-thirds. They never even took it to a vote. So there is no treaty between the United States and Hawaii, even though the Republic of Hawaii signed the treaty. What happened next kind of completes the story, which is the United States went to war against Spain in the spring of 1898 because it wanted to take Puerto Rico, it wanted to take the Philippines and Guam. And so someone said, while you're at it, why don't you take Hawaii? It's not Spanish, but it's on the way to the Philippines. And so in March of 1898, they introduced what is called the Newlands Resolution, which is really another word or another name for the Joint Resolution. The Joint Resolution is not a treaty. So it goes to the House and the Senate. And it only requires a majority vote in the House and a majority vote in the Senate to pass.
And Professor Chang, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it's the top of the hour. I need to tell people.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQ, Kilauea. This is Kauai Soapbox with Felicia. Professor Williamson Chang is on the air, and that is Lee Morey, who was asking him a question. Continue.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mrs. Morey, that I'm taking so long. But your question is really a good one, in that the Republic of Hawaii was willing to sign a treaty with the United States to where the bride of the United States would have taken Hawaii. Who stopped the treaty? Native Hawaiians protesting to the United States stopped the treaty, and the United States never ratified the treaty. The Republic of Hawaii ratified the treaty, but people forget that it's the United States that never ratified the treaty. What the United States did after the failure to ratify the treaty was pass a law because they could get a majority vote in the House and Senate to pass this law called the Joint Resolution. Now, it was merely a law or an act of Congress, and an act of Congress doesn't have the force and effect of a treaty. It cannot, you know, bind Hawaii to give to cede Hawaii's land to the United States. So they pulled basically a fast one, and they knew they were doing it because senators were just outraged that they would do this, and it was that outrage that was recorded in the congressional record that I read. So the Republic of Hawaii was willing to, by the terms of the treaty they drafted, give Hawaii to the United States. When the Joint Resolution was passed by the United States, the Republic of Hawaii said, we don't like the terms of the Joint Resolution. So there's never agreement between the Republic of Hawaii and the United States, even the annexationists like Dole and Thurston, as to giving Hawaii to the United States under any kind of terms, whether it would be a valid treaty. And if the treaty had passed, I wouldn't be talking as I am now. Hawaii would be part of the United States.
Well, I appreciate all that you're sharing. And for the listener, that is University of Hawaii Professor Williamson Chang. What we heard about an hour ago was some very significant victories that you brought forward with your law work, determining water is in the public trust, that we have access to the beach, many other elements. I appreciate your being on the show with us. For people who are just listening in, this will be on the KKCR archive. Professor Chang, I would love to have you on another show at some point in the not-too-distant future, because it sounds like you can educate a number of us on more of it. I would really like to be hearing about what happened in the more modern era, and then a bit about ownership rights of property. Joanne Yukimura. You guys might know each other, another lawyer.
Yeah.
And she is our councilwoman for a long time and former mayor. She is in the studio also, and her and Lee Morey, we are going to be talking about people's ability to have homes. Joanne, do you want to say hi to Professor Chang?
Aloha, Professor Chang.
Aloha, Joanne. It's been a long time.
Yes. I was listening, though, to your discussion in the last half an hour to 45 minutes. Thank you. Fascinating and
such landmark work
that you've done.
I've always admired you, and I think you're a real stalwart, courageous public service council and member and mayor. I just love what you did as a mayor of Kauai. So my hat's off to you. You're one of my heroes.
Oh, that's such an honor. I think it's the other way around.
No. I grew up on watching you, so, you know. It's really nice to hear you.
I'm thrilled to have everybody in here. And Professor Chang, thank you so much for giving the listener and us a good foundation in understanding the current angst of particularly the millennial generation, though I think it bleeds up. Many people that might be their parents even are suffering from the same challenges of contraction. And so I want to thank you, and I want to invite you on another show, and we're gonna start talking about housing and some of our localized issues.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and aloha.
Okay, aloha, and mahalo to your audience.
Thank you.
Okay.
So Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Moloa'a, K284AL, Haleiwa.
Thousands of cigarette butts litter our parks and beaches. Is Kauai an ashtray? Smokers, if you're in your car or at the beach, hang on to your butts. Protect ocean wildlife and keep Kauai clean. A reminder from the Surf Rider Foundation.
Shh! It's KKCR's Silent Fun Drive. From now until the start of our spring membership drive on May 11th, we encourage you to participate in our Silent Drive. All Silent Drive contributors will be entered into our early bird drawing for a chance to win a two-night stay at the beautiful Hanalei Bay Resort in Princeville. Our goal is $65,000. Help us get there by making a donation today. Call 808-826-7774 or visit kkcr.org. KKCR, Ke Kani o Kauai Nei, the sound of Kauai.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456.
So, mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. This is Kauai Soapbox with Felicia in the studio with me. I haven't even said anything to Marshall yet. Marshall's been in the say hello.
Aloha. Oh,
there we go. And then we have Councilwoman Joanne Yukimura and our friend Lee Morey, who has lots of knowledge and focus on the real property market, or, you know, more than that, but certainly land and housing and all of those elements. Joanne, so you were listening in on the conversation?
Fascinating. and obviously Professor Chang has done incredible research. It has huge implications, not just for Mauna Kea, that could take a long discussion and also a lot of recreation if that's what we have to do too.
Yeah, but it's a big piece. And then kind of zooming the lens back in, I was at the council meeting last Wednesday, so was Lee Morey, and one of the issues that came up, there's an ordinance right now to stop homestays, which is when people live in their house, but they maybe have a bedroom or two, or maybe in an adjoining building where people can basically stay the night. It's kind of like a bed and breakfast. It's just small scale, and I believe a core part of that definition is that the homeowner lives there. Is that correct?
Yes, there's an owner on site.
Yes. Yes, and so one of the things that I called Lee first about this because it's such a complicated issue. We have this constant challenge of more and more of our housing really being directed at a global market, whether it is through people on vacation, but even more, it seems like many people almost buy here as investment, just to hold their money. Is kind of better than a bank account in many ways when I look at it, or for others it might be like having a yacht. We certainly have some really benevolent people who invest here, so that's part of a direction maybe towards some solution, but you know, we got to look at how extensive is our form of capitalism. It's almost not even capitalism anymore. That it can be so out of balance. And Lee, am I correct? You have worked in affordable housing and providing housing for people?
In the early years of my career, I worked for a housing authority, and I worked with both low-income and elderly housing. That's establishing it and making it work. So I really see how difficult it can be here, having seen it done in Virginia, basically, is where I did it for about 10 years.
And Joanne, you helped to actually bring a number of these housing, affordable housing available for here, right?
Yes, about, when I was mayor, there had been, when I took office, there had been 7 houses created in the affordable housing program over the last 4 to 8 years, and there was a huge, this was in 1988, the market was really high, and people were, as they are today, doubling up, you know, paying a huge percentage of their household income for housing in order to survive, and it's a terrible situation in a community like ours where the world is the market for real estate. And as you said, Felicia, many people look to buy property here mainly for investment, and for our families to have to compete with that, or our farmers to have to compete with that, makes it really difficult to do the normal task of living here.
And when I look at, because I know a few people who do homestays, they have people live in their house, and I would, in those cases, they're doing what they can do to just barely keep their home, right? They do a nice job, but if they weren't able to do that, they might not know how to even have the home.
Well, they're not having people live in their house.
I mean,
they're having
for a couple nights, you know.
Yeah, they're having people be guests in their home. You know, I think we should start out by saying, as we determined when we were working on the transient vacation rental bill, which several years ago, that there's a real distinction between homestays and standalone vacation rentals where there's no owner there. It's a really different feel and different dynamic when you can't go and if you're a neighbor or someone in the community can't go and complain or check, get some accountability in terms of noise or parking or anything like that. So when we started on the TVR bill, we made that distinction up front, and we did say we would be regulating homestays at another time. They didn't seem to be the problem when we were doing standalone vacation rentals, but we waited too long. And of course, what precipitated this whole homestay thing is because those who are found to be illegal TVRs are now trying to get in under the homestay. I'm not sure how they're doing that if they don't live there, because that's a major distinction.
Okay, we have a quick phone call. I'm going to be taking short phone calls because there's a lot to be addressing. Aloha, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have a question. it's not with homestay, but I'm a parent and we have adult children, and we'd love to be able to do an extension on our home with a small kitchen to help our children. And there's just so many barriers. We can't do that. So I know this is an issue that goes on, and there's been so many things, but there's so many difficulties for families to take care of their family and yet have a little bit, you know, a separate unit, but yet within the home. So I just want to throw that out there.
Absolutely on point. Okay. Thank you. Joanne, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, and I think Lee might have some thoughts.
Would you like to share on that first?
Well, let me go back to the original issues with the homestay, too, though. Ka'ina Hull, who's the deputy planning director
of the county,
he very carefully explained to me why homestays were illegal. Now, I testified for them, not for them necessarily, but for the process to be kinder and more gentle to the people that were doing it.
Because we're looking at 320 identified homestays who could potentially lose their house over this.
And what Joanne said about a lot of TDR people trying to get in under that umbrella is true. And what Ka'ina...
TVR, temporary vacation rental.
Transient vacation rental.
Thank you.
Yeah. And
I tried to stay away from acronyms. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. And what Ka'ina explained to me was that the individuals that were trying to do this were doing so under language that they themselves had put into an ordinance which allowed people that were renting to be the person, the go-to person in the homestay. It didn't have to be owner-occupied. So that's how they were trying to slip in. And then he further explained that the reason that the homestay was illegal was because there is something in place, which is a use permit that should be gotten for the homestay, that I would be willing to bet about 99% of the people who operate homestays do not have. Now, because of that being illegal, they issued the cease and desist orders. And, you know, my opinion was, of course, well, you should rescind those cease and desist orders and let these people operate until they can sort out the issues. Because I understand that it's illegal. I also understand the general public does not know these rules. And unless they're told the rules very specifically and many times, they're not going to understand it. Now, as far as the extended families go, I would like to see our county do a little bit kinder and gentler method there, too, because that's one of the biggest issues, the number of kitchens you can have. And, you know, that all has to do with our ADU, additional dwelling unit laws that need to be probably revamped and sorted out to allow people to accommodate extended families.
Right, because something I actually appreciate and almost envy is there are communities here that have very vast extended families, and so it is a really important safety net. Sometimes they don't even need it as a safety net. They like to live together. And I think that that's how humanity is really designed. We're tribal people, so when people can all pile on each other in these houses, at least they have a home, right?
I want to address the question that was
posed by the caller.
Yeah, by the caller. Because it is one of the things that at least I have been looking at in terms of making more housing available. I believe the Appleseed Foundation, which is a law firm that works for nonprofits, they've been proposing it in Honolulu. I just haven't had the time to connect with them. But in certain areas where it would work, we could we could, by zoning, give a neighborhood the ability to do ADUs, additional dwelling units, for either granny units, you know, for parents who are aging who need to be closer by, or for young people who need a transition, or, you know, just to have an extended Ohana family living situation.
Not even necessarily blood, right? Or does it need to be blood?
I don't think it has to be blood related, but it should be one ownership.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't think we should allow is condominiumization of the the primary unit and the ADU unit, because
additional dwelling unit,
because you will have so many problems if it's not under the control of one owner. You know, you'll have boundary disputes, noise disputes.
Right.
People, you know, you'll have these, flag lots, and somebody will complain. Whereas it's better if you can sort it out, although it's not always easy, within a family rather than, and one, within one ownership rather than separate owners. But to do that, we would have to really, I mean, I would want to do that in urban areas, not in ag lots where we're trying to keep the densities low. But in urban areas, and we would have to figure out parking, whether there's enough water and sewer capacity, all of those things. So it would have to be very carefully planned. But it is one way, instead of giving a big developer a place to build affordable housing, you'd give multiple people the right and the capacity to build as they see fit, as long as we can have some guidelines so there's not undue conflicts that come about.
And maybe neighborhood associations. We have another caller who's going to ask a quick question. Thank you so much for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it? How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Hey, good.
I'm glad Joanne's in there and now she can answer questions.
Ah, Matt. I can tell the voice anywhere.
Yes.
You're not ready. But, you know, the one thing that I would like to, there's more than one thing I'd like to point out, but a couple of things I'd like to point out on this issue. You know, I would like to know if they have them or if they do have them, read them. You know, the intercommunications for the last 20 to 30 years on this issue, you know, that would be interesting to look at, to see, you know, in concrete that they have these policies.
Who's the county?
Because, you know, I mean, like Joanna, you guys talked about earlier about, you know, the county says that, oh, the only reason you're illegal is because you didn't fill out this special use permit. Well, where is the language that gave the due process to come up with that plan? Right? I mean, is it there? And how do we get this paperwork to read? Like everything that you guys do as a government has to have a due process step to it. Right? And so you guys didn't just come up one day and wake up and then throw that in there. That's just one little question that is probably rhetorical at this stage because it's probably not there. But that would be interesting to just read, you know, the paperwork leading up to all the paperwork associated with not just the B&Bs, but the TVRs.
So, Joanne, do you know any of the history of this? Can you speak to that? Is it a well-documented thread, or is it, kind of catch as catch can? You know, as things come up, we have all different sorts of changes.
Well, the transient vacation rental was the biggest problem because they were taking over neighborhoods. And because they were fueled by investment speculation, basically, you know, people who basically treat the property they have as an investment, it was becoming rampant in certain neighborhoods, like in Anini. You know, there were more than
Hanalei.
Yeah, Hanalei.
Hi, Anna.
And it was really ripping apart the fabric of community. I mean, I heard stories about campers at Anini going in and using the washing machine in units at Anini because nobody knew who was living there, who should be there, you know, that kind of thing. Nobody knew who was whom in the neighborhood. And it was also affecting the price. So we had to do something, and we took too long to do it. And the problem is that there was an established right So we had to grandfather people in.
I'm curious.
Well, that was an opinion that the right to do a vacation rental came as a standalone vacation rental came as part of a residence.
So, Matt, do you have another question?
I want to rebuttal to that because that's funny that you say it like that because residential zoning, by definition, you're not supposed to engage in any commercial activity. I don't understand that.
We did argue that, Matt. I'm on your side. But the attorneys, yeah. So it was a thing we had to work around, and unfortunately, you know, in taking time to put a law in effect regulating transient vacation rentals, there were a lot of people who went in and tried to establish them, and that was the hard part. So there's a certain value in not having the right to do even homestays because that stops this rush from happening, and we can look at the people who have been doing it, and I have some ideas about how you would be able to, certify them based on how long they've been doing this. And the thing to really acknowledge about homestays is it takes a lot of work compared to doing a transient vacation rental. You just hand that over to a management agent and you let them do it. But if you're a homestay, you have to fix breakfast, wash laundry, you know. And it takes some real commitment to that kind of business. And
I
it also takes...
Put up with the strangers.
Yeah,
I couldn't do it. Personally.
I couldn't do it either, Matt. And that's what makes this particular small business very selective in a way. I mean, we need to honor them, those who are willing to do it. There still is, if we allow everybody to do it, and neighborhoods become commercial businesses everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's still some problems.
One thing that I like what you said at the meeting on Wednesday, Joanne, was I like how you pointed out that some like in 1978 when these places were zoned, the let's get real, the plantation really ran the show. And so like let's give example of parcels in Molawa where in between sugar they didn't actually farm them because they didn't have a water source there or it was too vert, it wasn't able to mechanize or whatever the reason was. And so some of those parcels are deemed ag, but realistically they have wells that cost them big dollars because it's like as the aquifer drops over the last decade and a half, I know some people's they started off with a $400, $500 electric bill, and then as the aquifer goes down and you got to draw more water, the bill goes up, and the county, the water department didn't give those guys water specifically because they didn't want to be engaged in anything. There's a few lots out there that don't have county water. They were forced to put their own wells. And some of those lands, even though they're, have never been farmed, and maybe there is a crop out there that's farmable.
There is much agriculture going on in Moloa on the flatlands. And so the question is who's the water for and what is the priority for a scarce resource? But I think that's going off topic right now.
And Matt, thank you so much for calling in. I've got other people holding.
You're totally right. Thank you guys for coming in and putting your neck on the chopping board with the public.
Thank you. And aloha. You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. In the studio with me, Felicia on Kauai Soapbox, is Marshall, Councilwoman Joanne Yukimura, and Lee Mori, former past president of Kauai Board of Realtors and just a good citizen who knows a lot about this. Aloha, thank you for holding. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, I think it's me. I just have a question for Joanne in the name of disclosure and transparency. I'm wondering if Joanne still owns her rental home on Kalihiwai Beach and how that plays into any of her concerns about TDRs if she does.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for asking. I never owned Oceanside property, but did own property inside the valley at Kalihiwai, and that was sold in 2005. So I don't own any property there.
So it would sound like that's not something it's influencing your perspective certainly right now, but there's an inference and you're saying no, that that wouldn't anyway. Okay, here's a piece that I want to just make sure gets covered. This is my observation. When people can't afford their house, that's when they start to rent it out. When I watched a couple key industries leave Hanalei, it was a place that was dense with maybe multiple families in houses, but then it went to vacation rentals. And then as we see the pressure on vacation rentals with really high tax rates, it ends up being empty. So we have empty houses. So instead of even having a rental in them, we've got Fern on the line from Switzerland. Let's say hello to Fern. Fern.
Hi, Auntie Felicia.
We love you.
Oh, we love you too.
So, Swiss girl, tell us what's going on.
Oh my gosh, what a week! It's been incredible. We've learned so much over here. The people are just amazing.
Switzerland.
Yes, it's just been such an educational experience.
Tell the listener who might have just tuned in why you're there and what you're doing.
Yeah, so I've been in Switzerland for the last week. We've been meeting with different people throughout the country. Everybody from politicians to union workers and leaders to college students, to activists, everybody, just a huge range of people. And we learned so much about the culture here and why so many of these things are banned and the experiences that they've had over the last 50 years, really, of being the home of and the birthing place of these a lot of these chemicals and chemical corporations. And I got to attend some lectures by German scientists here that are historians and scientists that study and toxicologists that have studied the impacts of chemical overflow from landfills into the rivers here. And at one point, like 30 years ago, one of the landfills had overflown from the DDT and pesticide production plants, and landfills had leached into the river here, the Rhine River, and it killed everything to Amsterdam. And the lessons that they learned, 50 years ago about a lot of these chemicals, and learned a lot. I got to connect with Pesticide Action Network Germany through translation and through the help of a lot of people, because I don't speak French or German. It's been an incredible experience having these scientists translate their information over and share with us so that we could learn more. It's been a pretty powerful experience. We first met with a parliament representative on the national level that actually met his wife on hiking the Napali coast, and it was an amazing conversation. The constant is that everybody is so shocked that this place in the middle of the ocean that everybody connects to as paradise is where these chemical corporations have gone to experiment when they're not allowed to do that here. And it's just really been an eye opener. It's been a huge motivation for me too, and kind of a re-inspiration about what we've been doing and why we're doing it. And then to top it all off, we ended up yesterday at the shareholder meeting, which I'm sure Gary spoke about. I know he was going to call you this morning too.
Yes, he spoke, and then the film footage that you recorded was played on the show just prior to this one.
Awesome, and we actually have the whole audio in addition to in me filming the beginning and then the end. I also had him with the mic recording, so he's got the audio of the entire thing, which I intend to stitch together with a video that explains why they're kicking me out, because it was ridiculous. Like, they asked me, like, there was no notice that we couldn't film. Nobody said anything. And then when I got the camera out, and when he finally said it in English to stop recording, I stopped recording and I put it down and I put my camera away. And like 30 seconds later, he came up and said, "You need to turn over your camera." And I said, "Excuse me?" And he goes, "I need to take your camera." And I was like, "Excuse me?" And he said it again, "I need to take your camera." And I said, that's not going to happen. Like,
at least you're 6 feet tall.
I was like, it's not going to happen. And he's just like, well, you need to leave. And then two security guards helped me stand up and escort me out. And I like grabbed my stuff and I went, oh my gosh, if they're going to kick me out anyway, I'm going to record. So I turned back around and I started recording again. And that's when I walked out on the second part of that video. You can see me walking through the shareholders, and out the front door right as Gary is making the final request for them to drop the lawsuit, comply with our laws, and give us the same protection and respect that they give the people in Switzerland.
Well, thank you. And are you coming home today?
It takes a while to get home, but we're just starting the transit. So.
I mean, you're getting on the plane. You're leaving today.
Yeah, we're preparing to leave, yeah.
Well, we're proud of you. Thank you for representing. And for those who don't know, our awesome Fern, she's with Ohana o Kauai. And you've really, really made a lot of difference here on this island that you grew up on.
Yeah, I really learned a lot. I can't wait to bring it home and apply what I've learned because of the chemicals I've learned so much more about. And, like, some of them, there's agreements that they've already committed to that they were going to stop using them, and they're still using them. And there's just so much I learned about ways that they're violating other agreements. And I really look forward to following up.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're going to come in the studio with me and talk story. Is that what you're saying?
We can definitely do that. Yeah, absolutely. I just need to really fact-check and cross-check a lot of the information that I'm getting translated out of German and make sure that, you know, I'm correct about what it is. I'm going to go back and read these papers. Some of the people throughout Germany and Switzerland and even France are working to get me information translated so that I have a better understanding of different agreements and chemicals and what, yeah, it's really incredible. I don't want to say too much, but
you're getting a vigorous nod of the head from your Auntie Joanne here about getting your facts straight.
nice, awesome.
Good work, Vern.
We love her.
We love you.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, thank you, guys. We're going to, I'll let you all continue, but I just wanted to call in and thank Kauai for motivating me to be here and take this as far as we have.
Well, thank
Malia's
you.
Malia's here with me.
Yes. Malia, does she want to say aloha to everybody for half a second so her mother can hear her? I was with Lorna.
Yeah, hold on. Lorna. We're all, like, recovering for our 3 hours.
Yes. I'm just telling the listener I was with Lorna, who is Malia and Mason's mother, at the Water Commission field trip today, and Lorna is probably listening. So, Malia, say hello. Hey, Mom.
Hey, Mom. Hey, aloha, Felicia. How are you doing?
Good. So we're proud of you guys, and I'm sure you'll be...
It's been a journey out here. Yeah, we've learned so many valuable lessons, so we're really grateful for that, the opportunity and the support of our international brothers and sisters. It just makes you realize how small the world really is and how we're so interconnected as collective stewards of this land, this world, really. So, yeah, it was, it's been a nonstop journey for us. We've been on the go and with very little rest in between, but definitely well worth the experience, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, and you have a safe journey home.
Mahalo nui.
Mahalo nui.
Mahalo Kauai. We love you guys. Hui ho.
Ahui ho.
Aloha.
So we have about 22 minutes before Jazz with John is on. He's come in, and so we have this big nebulous topic about housing, so trying to bring it in a little bit. Like, I will be honest, I got all kinds of ideas and don't really know where to start.
Well, you were talking about... families that are having a hard time affording their homes.
Right, and it gets pushed out. And something I'm really behind, this is something I'm behind, so I'm pitching right now. I like some of the stuff with the form-based code that the planning department is coming up with, where you can have areas that people can have commerce out of their houses. Like if you cut hair, you make lathes, or you babysit, or I think micro-business is a very important way to have people live in their homes and all around the world. That's normal.
Right. The thing is that the single family subdivision is not probably the best way to have it. It's very spread out. It has a lot of problems with parking and cars. Whereas the more urban environment, towns, and it doesn't have to be high rise, but just more dense, where you would be closer to your clientele and customers. And, you know, it actually would follow some of the old fashioned ways that used to be done. You see it with the building on Kalena Street where Kauai Fishing Supply is.
In Lihue, right off Rice Street,
right
by the dense area.
Close to the fire department and that little park there. You had business on the ground and residents on the top, you know. And that's very old-fashioned.
All over the world.
Right. And that kind of, and I think even there's a law firm, Jim Lick has mm-hmm. a law office on the bottom, residence
Lou.
On the top. So if we can have and a very walkable environment with sidewalks and sufficient parking, but not actually a design where you don't need to have a car close by, but you can walk to places, we could really work on that. And we have to work on the others. One thing I want to say about affordable housing, after working on this issue for about 40 years now, I think we have to insulate our affordable housing from the market, because once it goes into the market, it's not affordable anymore.
And I appreciated that you asked those questions at the last meeting, because we can't have them all just go back out at market rate. This is my fear. I'm going to speak directly to my fear, is that we are going to become like Lanai. And when I even hear the term workforce housing, which I appreciate we're having a big workforce housing place put in, but to me I look at Lanai and it is workforce housing for these big hotels. And I joke and say on the North Shore we're an inverse bell curve of normal people. It's the rich and those who wash their cars, but now they're even the rich are bringing the people who wash their cars on a short-term piece. And so how, and Lee, do you have any ideas? How do we not overmarket our island externally? And it's not up to the realtors too much if that happens. It's really the market itself. Do you have any ideas of how to shift that?
That's right. I think realtors have been demonized as selling Kauai, but it's not the realtors that sell Kauai. It's the owners that sell Kauai. The realtors facilitate it, try to keep it straight, try to keep it legal, try to keep it ethical transaction, and that's basically what we do. Now, as far as affordable housing goes, I agree with Joanne. We cannot build it and then sell it and basically have it go away. It has to be built so that it's there in perpetuity, however that is going to be, whether it's passed down through families, whether it's only rentals. It's got to be so that it's there for the general public, because our median income is right now is like $62,000 a year. On an income like that, you really can't afford anything that's out there in the market. Mm-hmm. So it's unfair to expect our citizens to be able to, unless we provide something. You know, we're going to have to sell bonds. We're going to have to do a lot of things. We're going to have to make it first attractive to someone from the outside to develop it. That's very difficult, because outside developers don't want to do anything unless they're actually making money. But there are federal programs that they can incorporate where they will make money. We can sell bonds. There's a lot of things that we can do as a county to help this problem.
Well, you know, in fact, we have an inclusionary zoning law which says if you want to do market housing, you have to do 30% that is affordable. And over the years, we used to allow it to be anywhere. We're encouraging it now so that it's close to the market housing, because often that's where the jobs are. But more importantly, that's where the big infrastructure is. So if say a big landowner is like A&B or Kukuiula,
Alexander and Baldwin.
Yes. They're putting in their, you know, Kukuiula's develop. They have to develop water, sewers, roads, utilities, etc. And so to have it close by makes it easy to provide that kind of infrastructure for the affordable housing, because they're doing it anyway. If it's way off, miles away, then you have to create a whole new infrastructural system.
And what's either one of your reactions to communities? I'm seeing an ever-increasing, whether it's a demand or it's already happening, where it's mostly young people living on a piece of land, and they're figuring out a way to kind of coexist in a clannish way so that they can have a place that they can afford to be. I know that there was a bill before the legislature to try and find a way to zone for that, but I...
For young people?
Well, not for young people,
this
but
sounds
it happens...
like a commune.
No. If you do multifamily housing, and you do it nicely, and you do it close to town, because young people really like to be with each other, and they like to be close to the restaurants. And I mean, look at Kapaa Town, and to put some housing around there would be fabulous, because it would make it walkable. But even Lihui Town, having, I think there's, we're still stuck on, we need single-family housing. That's going to be the main form of our housing, and I think we're behind the times. And we have a couple of callers holding. Aloha, you're on the air, and we'll take a quick question or comment.
Yeah, I had a comment about something you were saying earlier about, you know, trying to make your property and your business one with separation. And so it would be nice for professional people or whatever they do, like Ag Open, where they are zoned for a legal guest house, but they can't operate a business out of it.
Like a massage thing or acupuncture
or
something.
Acupuncture, artists. I mean, people who don't need that big flow, but they maybe have one person an hour at the most there, you know, and yet they can't do that. So that's like, they have to go to work somewhere else, even if they have the space and on their own property.
So I hear that's a concern. Many people bring it up, and thank you so much for bringing that up.
Thank you.
So that's kind of complex. I'm going to be honest. I tend to like not react badly to that, because like if you go and you get acupuncture, I know the acupuncturist that I used to go to, she had to leave because it was a problem. But you know, you have one customer at a time. What's the difference between that and having a friend stop by?
Well, if you start allowing non-ag commercial in ag land, mm-hmm. it's the precursor to non-ag mm-hmm. over
yeah.
time.
Right.
And so, I mean, we have to make up our minds about what we want ag land to be. And the other thing is ag land becomes rural, and it becomes very low density, and it's very expensive to service low density development.
You said, Joanne, something at the council meeting about examining the ag lands
yes.
and the actual use on the important and the registered.
What I said is that when they first, the state did state, it's called zoning informally, it's mm-hmm. not technically zoning, but they created these four districts, which are conservation, urban, ag, and rural. They kind of did all the conservation lands, all the urban lands, and then they used ag as the catch-all. And they just threw all the lands that weren't conservation or urban in there, which means some of them are the primest ag land, the flat, sunny lands that really grow crops well. But they're also the mountainous lands, they're, you know, ravines, they're... So they're not all good ag lands, and we're trying to regulate ag lands with one set of regulations. But on the other hand, if it's not ag and you do it rural, that becomes low density sprawl. Right now, rural is thankfully, we have only very small rural designated land, but that's half-acre lots with an additional dwelling unit. It's a quarter acre. It's essentially an urban designation, and you can't have urban all over the island. I mean, that kind of rural urban sprawl.
But you also said that you may be addressing those lands that are zoned agricultural, but it is completely impractical to have an agricultural activity there. And because there were some individuals that were at the meeting that's where they had their homestay, because
right.
it was impossible
right.
to have an ag activity.
Well, and yes, there was one lady in Moloa up on a hill with no flat land for ag. However, the water system is a water system that was created for ag, and the plan for the county was not to create more urban towns or centers at Moloa'a, but the more it becomes residential, there's some competition between water for ag and water for
right.
residential. So it's very all kinds of complications. For a homestay, it makes sense.
We have a lot of complicated
yes. Yes,
elements. I want to give a few shout-outs. I'm giving some shout-outs to the government.
Good.
I went on the Water Commission field trip today in Waimea, and I want to acknowledge that Suzanne Case is out there hiking with us. That's the new Department of Land and Natural Resources person on day one. Denise, I really like her. Forget, she's got an Italian last name. I should be able to say
Antolini.
It. Antolini. She was there. Most of the Water Commission was there. Earth Justice was there. A number of the contractors that are, you know, helping the government make choices. But the Water Commission is going to be meeting tonight at 5:30 or 6 o'clock at the Civic Center where the Planning Commission is. They came back. I went to the original meeting, and we said, hey, come back. And they're back today and then tomorrow morning, so that's a place where people can come in and be heard. I want to acknowledge the Department of Transportation, the Hawaii Highways. They had a listening session. I happened to go to the one in Waimea. They did one in Lihue, Waimea, and Hanalei, where they're coming, wanting to hear, particularly for Hawaiian cultural and historical sensitivities. So they'll be way proactive on what we call Section 106. Often that, when people complain and say, this was a really significant spot, that happens the 11th hour after everything's been planned. And so that was a good thing. I went to the Lihue Business Association meeting this week, too, where they had green energy. People were in there talking about what's going on. They're basically up and running now. It's in what they're calling the tune-up phase, but they are creating energy and burning. And so, of course, when I'm driving by this morning to Waimea and back, I'm looking pretty hard and closely. Not seeing smoke, not seeing a real huge impact. I can see the trucks bringing the logs from the burn up at, Waimea Canyon coming down, not creating a traffic hazard, so I was happy to see that. They did say that I could go on a tour of the green energy plant. I really like to always have firsthand information. I went to an Aha Moku meeting in Moku Puna. Walter Riddy came. Really a riveting discussion of what is going on Oahu this past week. But many people are energized and motivated, and the Department of Land and Natural Resources has created this vehicle for people to be working to bring in traditional land management systems. And I wanted to also give a little shout-out to Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, who had a rolling blackout last night. I think it's actually important for us to experience those. It's easy for me to say because I got a solar system on my house, so even with the power out, I don't have a power outage, so I get to go ha 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 on that one. But the main generator is under routine maintenance this week, so it shows us how vulnerable we are. So the second biggest generator that's a little bit older, I don't know if it's because it was bearing all the weight, but whatever reason, it had a mechanical problem. So they moved the energy around. So really that's good. It doesn't create some crisis where somebody's freezer completely melts and they had it back together. and it was in the peak time. Do you have something to say on that, Joanne?
I just want to say that we need to really look with KIUC at that pump storage idea, because that will give us more firm power and renewable power.
And those people were there with us in the walk, and I was speaking with them, and I would like to bring them in here to talk about that.
Good.
So we can take the energy produced by the sun to pump the water up in the peak times, and the more power we have from the sun, the more vulnerable we are to things like clouds, which do happen here. But we had a really good conversation on this trip about the lesser amounts of water. And we were seeing where the diversions are, but the diversions aren't substantial. There's just not a lot of water. So that's a problem. We're seeing a change in the weather.
Yeah, and that's one of the spinoffs from global warming, we think.
We think so.
Yeah.
And what I started the show with is, and for those of the people who are listening, I see people from around the world, and I am, we're on, the show seems to happen on Facebook, too, a lot of dialogue going on there. And so my Pakistani friends, they've had terrible floodings, more deaths, and each year they just get washed away, and that is their own environmental mismanagement. Certainly global climate change, but localized environmental mismanagement. Mm-hmm. So we have that. And then with the earthquake in Nepal and these volcanoes erupting, I have at least seen that some of that's the melting of the ice. Mm-hmm. It moves the pressure that's on the plates on the planet, and so they sit there and readjust.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, as you pointed out, there's this melding of natural forces and how human forces and decision-making. I was listening on the radio, too, that in Nepal, the worst damage was done in the homes that weren't properly built. And I'm recalling that after Hurricane Iniki, we pushed through a new building code that required all the hurricane straps, and how that makes a difference, too, when you do have a natural disaster, how you've built your homes. Really makes
it
a
makes
difference.
A huge difference, and if you can afford it, it's great. And if all you can afford is a shack, you can't have a shack anymore. So it's this.
Well, the straps
could work on a shack.
Well, they added only 1% more of the cost, so it was really cost effective to do the right thing.
The straps, and even any little thing in my yardin, I put those hurricane hooks on, and people say you're overbuilding. I say no, I'm not. Hey, a shout out to my roofer, Mark's Roofing. Changed my roof this past weekend. One day off, one day on. I was prepped for it to be some big trauma. Pushed it out for 5 years, and was no big deal. So that's something that, you know, we all have to do. A lot of good things happening. So we have time for one final round of just a very quick exit, because we're going to listen to the county council report. We all know what's going on. The county council is very important. And then it's Jazz with John. Do you want to say goodbye?
Oh, aloha. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Felicia, I just want to thank you for hosting these kinds of discussions, which really help educate the public. And you do it with such style and class and calmness and generosity. So,
well, thank you. And it's my honor, and I get to have an education all the time out of it. So it's really, really a great thing. Oops.
Thank you so much, Lee and Joanne, for coming in, and Felicia, another great show. And everyone, aloha.
Aloha. So we're going to hear the county council report.
Aloha, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's a county council report for the week of April 27th. There will be a special council meeting this week at 8:45 and a council committee meeting at 9. The meetings will be on Wednesday in the council chambers in the historic county building in Lihue. Here's some highlights from the agendas. The purpose of the special meeting is to interview Jeffrey S. Aida, candidate for the Civil Service Commission with a term ending on 12/31/2017. For the committee meeting, the Planning Committee has on their agenda two bills. They are Bill 2571, Draft 1, for an ordinance establishing procedures, development plans, and future growth areas for the Lihue Planning District, and this was deferred from April 1st. Also, Bill 2585 for an ordinance amending the county code relating to the Public Access, Open Space, and Natural Resources Preservation Fund. Public hearing was held on this bill on April 22nd. The Economic Development and Intergovernmental Relations Committee has a request from Committee Chair Ku'uli'i for the Director of Economic Development to provide an update on the proposed operations of the Kilauea Agricultural Center. This was deferred from March 18th. The Budget and Finance Committee has on their agenda Bill 2584 for an ordinance amending the county code relating to real property taxes. This is to reinstate the credit union exemption, and a public hearing was held on this on April 22nd. For more information, visit the county's website at www.kauai.gov. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Aloha.
And very interesting show, Felicia.